Good morning again, friends. Mike Allen here, hour two of the Mike Allen Show here on this Monday, March 28th. I certainly pray that you have had a blessed Easter Triduum, the Easter day. And the beautiful thing is we get to bask in the light of this Easter season, including the 50 days of resurrection hope that we celebrate, and certainly pray God's richest blessings upon you. I'm not in the studio today. I'm enjoying some time with my family. But you do have a best of interviews show that you can enjoy. Some of the best interviews we've had over the last couple of months sort of cobbled together. And this segment, I'll be talking to Leah Labresco. Now, Leah Labresco is a very interesting person, intellectual, young woman who was a very popular atheist blogger who went through her own conversion, not only to the Christian faith, but became a Catholic. And she now writes, among other things, for 538.com, which is a stat geek's Xanadu. And she's written recently on the Supreme Court case involving abortion and Texas regulations and the mathematics of what it means for an undue burden when it comes to abortion. So my conversation last month with Leah Labresco. So tell us just a little bit for the listeners who aren't aware about this case, Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt, and what it's about.
All right. So this is a case about what are sometimes called trap laws on abortion. So these are laws that restrict the way that clinics can operate rather than restrict which women can get an abortion and when. So what Texas did is it set out more stringent medical criteria for how abortions operate, for how abortion clinics operate. Doctors have to have admitting privileges at local hospitals in case a woman has a problem and needs to be sent there. And they need to have different kinds of buildings. They need to match an ambulatory surgery center, which basically means that sometimes an entire building will need to be remodeled so that stretchers can get through all the hallways and other things like that. And these are standards that a lot of abortion clinics in Texas couldn't meet. So when the law went into effect, a lot of them closed.
And so a lawsuit has been brought, I guess, or, you know, to see the Texas laws as unconstitutional because of, I think you related it to a 1992 case. Some are saying this is the biggest abortion case since that case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey.
Yeah, so there's been kind of two huge abortion cases, and that's obviously Roe v. Wade, in which the Supreme Court found a right to an abortion, and then Casey is the second big case, and that's the 1992 case, which changed the way that restrictions on abortion were judged. So before Casey, when a state restricted a woman's ability to get an abortion, it was judged by something called strict scrutiny, which is a pretty high standard in constitutional law. It meant that the state needed to have a compelling interest in restricting a woman's ability to get an abortion, and it needed to have done it in the least restrictive way it possibly could. Casey changed that and opened the door to more restrictions on abortion. Hmm. Casey said that there just couldn't be an undue burden on women seeking an abortion. But the problem is really how that undue burden is defined.
That's interesting that you say that, Leah, because I know some pro-lifers look at Planned Parenthood versus Casey as a disaster for the pro-life movement because it reaffirmed what really had been affirmed for the first time in Roe, that there is this implicit constitutional right to abortion. But from your point of view, in terms of restricting abortion, it was, in that sense, it was actually a positive.
I mean, the interesting thing is sometimes both sides will view a decision as a defeat because they didn't get what they wanted from it. But I think it's unquestionably much easier to defend Texas's laws under the standards set out in Casey than it would have been under Roe.
Hmm. So what is the trick or the challenge for determining the proper math, let's say, of an undue burden?
So the problem is how much of a burden counts as undue. And what the Supreme Court had basically said is it's too big a burden if, quote, a large fraction of the women affected by the law can't get an abortion as the result. And do you hear where a large fraction didn't actually result in the definition anywhere there?
Yeah. So that's the problem.
So that's a big part of the problem. So circuit courts have kind of been making this up on their own without a single standard for the country. And one thing that could happen in this case is that we could just get a much clearer decision on how far a restriction can go before it's unconstitutional. Because right now, it's a big, blurry mishmash. But one of the problems is that even if we had all decided, like, okay, 30% is a large fraction, can't go any bigger than that, it's actually really hard to compute the impact of a law. So even a clear numerical standard wouldn't necessarily mean that courts had an easy time ruling on these. I looked at one case that was back in 2006 at the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. So this isn't nationally binding. But they were trying to figure out what the impact of a waiting period rule was, where a woman had to come in, meet a doctor, and couldn't get an abortion for 24 hours after that, and then she could go. That required some women to make a longer trip or two trips, and the question was, is that an undue burden? And the problem was, you know, both sides had to figure out, well, who's affected by the law, because that's the test. It's who would be affected by the law, not all women. And that comes out of Casey, where they were looking at the spousal notice requirement and said that the proper group of women to compare it to is all women who didn't want to notify their spouses, not just all women. The woman who was fine with telling her husband really wasn't affected by the law. And so when the Sixth Circuit looked at this waiting period law, they'd figure out, all right, who counts as affected by a waiting period? You know, and they did the math and figured out that for every 1,000 women who sought an abortion, that there would be 6 to 13 women who both were in an abusive relationship, were afraid to make two appointments because they didn't want their partner to know, and wouldn't get an abortion if this law were in effect. And that's why they focused on abused women particularly. It's a little weird in the history of the case, but it's mostly because they thought that was the clearest case of someone being burdened by the law. So you have 6 to 13 women out of 1,000. Well, that's a tiny fraction, is what the state said. 6 to 13 women out of all 1,000 who sought to get an abortion. The other side said, what do you mean all women who sought to get an abortion? It's the women who are affected by the law, and many of those 1,000 don't have a hardship from going twice. They wanted to compare those 6 to 13 women from all women who got an exemption from a waiting period previously, which would have bumped it up to around 12.5%. And the court looked at all this and goes, eh, both of you are wrong. Neither of those is the correct denominator. It shouldn't be all women who get an exemption. It should be all women who ask for an exemption, because those are women who feel burdened in some way, regardless of whether they get what they want. But that number didn't even exist, so no one could compare anything to that. And the court threw up its hands and went, well, our number is going to be smaller than 12.5%, and 12.5% isn't a large fraction, so our number wouldn't be a large fraction if we could actually compute it, and this part of the law could stay.
We're talking with Leah Labrette.
I was going to say, as a mathematician, that sounds like a big mess to me.
Absolutely. We're here with Leah Labresco of 538.com and talking about the math problem of how to determine whether something is an undue burden or not. So are you expecting, therefore, you think that this case, I mean, I guess if it ends in a 4-4 tie with, of course, the late Justice Scalia not on the court now, its impact will be less significant. But could it be the sort of case that gives a better sense of what the math of an undue burden is?
It could be. This question came up in oral argument. Justice Ginsburg got into a bit of a heated exchange with Texas Solicitor Scott Keller about, again, how to measure this fraction for Texas. So one of the wrinkles here is that this is a restriction on clinics, not on women. So who counts as affected by the law? The law doesn't pertain to any specific group of women. And that's why Keller from Texas argued that the right way to compute the fraction is to look at all women in Texas, because the law doesn't specifically target any of them. And Ginsburg said you shouldn't count women who are still near clinics that are open. You would only be looking at the impact of the law on women who could no longer easily reach a clinic. You know, that's really something that hasn't been pinned down and defined before. How do you judge the impact of a law on clinics as an undue burden rather than a law on women? But honestly, having read through the oral argument, I'm not optimistic this will actually be a case that provides that much guidance in the future, because a lot of the time it sounds like the justices were very eager to push the case back to the circuit court in the remand, which is when they send them back and ask them to hear it again and reconsider, just to see, well, is there something else you could do? Is there more data that could have been gotten? Is there a decision that could be made just for 3 years to cover the time till more clinics could have opened that are compliant? So it sounded like some of the justices were interested in really not having a new sweeping abortion decision and just having a very small particular to this case one.
One of the things that I have wondered, you know, I mean, from a pro-life perspective, you know, there's that whole concept of
if you're not going to overturn Roe v. Wade, if you're not going to, you know, if it's too entrenched in either the cultural, you know, values or, you know, in constitutional or, you know, interpretation, it's that whole, you know, how can you be wise as a serpent and innocent as a dove? You know, how can you therefore come at the availability of abortion, reduce the number of abortions? Is there a danger here in this Texas law that those who pass the Texas law have overplayed or you know, they've tried to go too far and to where if this does get slapped down, it's going to have a damaging effect on other persons who try to have restrictions?
I think it's possible that that's the case. The Texas laws have gone further than most other state laws, though a lot of things that are going on in other states would probably still be kosher even if Texas's laws are struck down, unless it's a very, very sweeping opinion, which frankly I wouldn't expect. Certainly kind of Texas was in its best position bringing this case now when they thought Scalia would hear it. And even now that Scalia is gone, when a different justice by Obama hasn't been named to the court yet. So we'll see. I'm guessing ultimately this case won't have a tremendous impact on access to abortion nationwide, but I could be proved wrong by the court.
Mm-hmm. Well, Leah, we're about out of time, unfortunately. I always enjoy having you on. You did great work with 538. You're a perfect fit for that website, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
And check out her book. It's called Arriving at Amen, Seven Catholic Prayers That Even I Can Offer, and her blog, Unequally Yoked, as well as her work at 538. Leah, have a great day.
You too.
We'll be back in a couple of minutes, and I'll have a conversation with Tony Rossi of the Christopher's Media Ministry, and we'll be talking about Kelly Clarkson's father wound and the healing she has found. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back here on The Mike Allen Show. Past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show. That's the sweet vocals of Kelly Clarkson, who won the very first American Idol way back in the day. And to be honest with you, I'd forgotten American Idol was still going on. I think the last season I watched was when Taylor Hicks won. But I came across an article by my friend Tony Rossi, who writes for the Catholic ministry, the Christophers. Tony Rossi, who is a graduate of St. John's University in New York, with degrees in communications and English. This has found a job with the Christophers, as he says, allows him to indulge his interest in religion, media, and pop culture. Served as the Christophers TV producer for 11 years and currently the host and producer of the organization's radio show podcast, Christopher Close Up. Tony, hello.
Good morning, Mike. Good to be with you again.
It's great to have you. Yeah, like I said, Kelly Clarkson's one of these people that I could listen to sing the phone book, you know. So I didn't need an excuse to watch a clip of her singing, but when I saw the clip that you had posted, it was a powerful one indeed.
It was. I mean, I was watching the show Thursday night. Unlike you, I've stuck with the show through all 15 seasons, and I'm sad to see it go. But, you know, Kelly Clarkson, to me, always had a very, just in addition to her singing talent, there was always just a very down-to-earth quality about her that I think makes her very relatable and likable. And so when she sang this song called Piece by Piece at the end of Thursday night's show, it was a really powerful moment because I didn't realize her background, that with her father, that he had left the family when she was 6 years old, and the impact it had on her emotions. I mean, there's lyrics in the song about how she felt worthless after he left. She tried to establish a relationship with him then, and he really wasn't interested, and just what that does to a young woman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think, you know, in general, young men too, if their fathers abandon them, there's plenty of studies on that. But for her in particular, it was just she as a catharsis, she wrote this song and got a lot of the emotion out of her, and she showed a lot of emotion when she sang the song on Thursday night too. So It's a really powerful song that I think a lot of people should go seek it, listen to it. Go to Christophers.org and find the link to our blog, and you can watch it there, or wherever, but it's an outstanding song.
Yeah, and we'll put a link to it on the show's Facebook page as well. In fact, I want us to listen here to maybe a minute or so of her singing this piece, which looks back on her own wound in her own life, but the healing that she's found in her current husband and marriage. So let's play a clip of that there, Ethan.
And all I remember is your back, walking towards the airport, leaving us all in your past. I traveled 1,500 miles to see you. I begged you to want me, but you didn't want to. But piece by piece, he collected me up off the ground where you abandoned things. Yeah, piece by piece, he filled the holes that you burned in me. Yeah, 6 years old, and you know, he never walks away. He never asks for money. He takes care of me, 'cause he loves me. Piece by piece, he restored my faith that a man can be kind and a father could stay.
Wow. I'm my kids accuse me of being a big softy anyway, but I wasn't alone. I mean, as I started to blubber watching that, Keith Urban was just a wreck, and lots of people in the crowd, because you can push past all the celebrity. And but everybody's got those heartfelt disappointments, difficulties, wounds in their life, and so many times, often it comes from our family life.
I remember seeing Keith Urban very teary-eyed, because I mean, he's the father of daughters, and I know he himself lost his father last year sometime, so it probably resonated. But I mean, really, it's we sometimes complain about, you know, negative impact of songs in popular culture. But this is a song, I think, that can have a positive impact on popular culture. It can remind young people and fathers to kind of step up to the plate when they have that responsibility of a child, and how important it is to let their kids know they're loved. I mean, I've been blessed with a mother and father who always let me know they love me. And it's just it's a powerful thing. And later on the song, there's a lyric, because Kelly herself is a mother of a young daughter named River Rose, and she writes the lyrics, "She will never have to wonder her worth, because unlike you, I'm going to put her first." So, I mean, that's a nice touch. And again, in case your listeners don't know, Kelly E. Clarkson is 7 months pregnant, going to have a baby boy, which she referenced during the show. Apparently the child started doing kicks during one of the performances. So she's in a family way, but she really brought a family feel to that episode of American Idol, and to the song. I mean, it's the morning after the Oscars, which celebrated storytelling of sorts. But, you know, when the song clip you just played, that was a powerful story through song. Just those lyrics paint pictures that are very cinematic to me, because I can picture the little girl standing at the airport with the man walking away. So it's a great song. Everybody should check out.
Here with Tony Rossi of The Christophers, talking about Kelly Clarkson's performance on the last season of American Idol the other night. You put in the piece here on your Christophers blog about the interview that she had with the Associated Press. One of the things I think is important is that, even though there's obviously a lot of hurt there, it's not a bitter song. I mean, it's a very honest song, but she talks about, even in that interview, how she says, "I'm not in that place anymore, like where I'm sad about it. I'm in a very forgiving place about it," and everybody's human. So it really is a hopeful song about the impact we can have in our own families and bringing healing to each other.
Yeah, I mean, she does say that, you know, she was watching her baby girl with her husband, and how that really taught her. She didn't even really understand how much she missed her own father growing up until she saw her husband with their daughter. And she realized that was the image of what it could be like. And, you know, I've talked to a number of people through the years who've had, were maybe abandoned by their fathers. And one of the things I always ask them is, you know, did not having a good father role model here on earth affect your perception of your heavenly father in heaven? And they said sometimes it could. It was hard for them to accept that a heavenly father could give unconditional love when their earthly father didn't. And, you know, or I know Kelly is a Christian believer. She was raised, I think, Southern Baptist, and you know, I don't know how religious she is, but I do know she's a believer. I mean, even during her judging, she kept telling people that they're so blessed. And usually when people use the word blessed instead of lucky or something, that's always a sign that there's some kind of faith element there. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if that being raised in the faith of the Christian faith helped Kelly maybe get to that place where she is willing to forgive and understand human frailty, which is what she said about her father in that interview.
You know, this is the kind of story that would seem like it's right in the Christopher's wheelhouse because, I mean, I think part of the culture of the Christophers is that not to take that, you know, circle the wagons culture war mindset exclusively, to recognize there are damaging things and distorted things in the culture, but to look for truth where it is and to look for those signs of hope and redemption. And talk about maybe a little bit about that from the Christopher's perspective, even about American Idol as a whole, which I think has had some of those elements in it.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, I grew up a big TV guy. I just like TV. Some people are movie people. I like movies, but I'm more of a TV guy. And I know people complain there's nothing good on television, but I've actually found quite a bit of it through the years. And American Idol, especially this last episode where all the contestants were talking about how they used to sit down and watch this show with their families. And, you know, family viewing, I think that's something else that might, you know, be going out of style nowadays because everybody's watching TV separately on their computers and on their phones. So for a family to sit down together and watch TV, and what overall has been a pretty, you know, wholesome, family-friendly show. There have been some moments here and there maybe that didn't fit the bill, but overall, this is a show families can watch together. They can kind of, you know, watch these kids achieve their dreams and strive for their dreams. And a lot of them have been inspired by it. So, you know, I think we need to find the good in popular culture. It's not all bad out there. You know, there's plenty of bad stuff, but the TV world is so diverse nowadays that there really is things you can find for everybody, whether it's on regular TV or cable TV. And I think for 15 years, American Idol has served that purpose. And I know the viewership has declined from its heyday, but I still think it's going to be missed in terms of that kind of family viewing that people can watch together.
Yeah, and it's good to see, you know, whether with that performance by Kelly Clarkson and to see, you know, in these celebrity guests how, you know, they can still be moved. Obviously, I mean, Jennifer Lopez too, just her whole demeanor was powerful through that whole song.
Yeah, no, I mean, she's come across as very well. And she always had a reputation as a diva, but once I saw her in this show, I kind of got a different side of her. Maybe she's a diva behind the scenes, but on air, at least, she's very friendly and, you know, she's very encouraging. She's like, she seems to understand where the kids are coming from and she wants to help them, which I think is just a great quality for a judge on this kind of show to have.
We got about a minute left. You'd want to give anybody a better insight on what the Christophers are about?
Sure. The Christophers were a Catholic media organization, and we celebrate the motto that it's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. So in whatever aspect of your life, you know, you may be having troubles, we encourage people to light that metaphorical candle and move toward a brighter future. We do it mainly through storytelling. We use radio and print and our website to tell those kinds of stories that reflect that idea. And in popular culture and everything. So, you know, give us a shot and just apply that principle to your life, that light a candle instead of curse the darkness today. It's Monday. It's the start of a new week. So, you know, start it with that idea in mind.
It's Leap Day. See, I think all accounts should be cleared on Leap Day, in my opinion.
That's right.
Hey, Tony, blessings. Thanks for your great work.
Thank you, Mike. Great being on the show again.
All right. We'll be back in just a minute with Mark Bentley to look back at the Oscars last night. This is The Mike Allen Show. We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on The Mike Allen Show here on this Easter Monday. Hope you've had a beautiful holiday and continue to have a glorious Easter octave and Easter season ahead. Again, I'm not live in the studio, enjoying some time off with family, but have no fear. I've compiled some of my favorite interviews over the last several months for your enjoyment. Next, I'll be talking to Mark Bentley of the Diocese of Lexington. He's a seminarian at St. Meinrad's.
I was watching the Oscars a few weeks ago and saw where he was commenting online on Facebook and thought, you know, I tried last year to get Mark. This time I'm going to try again to get him to comment from his perspective on the Academy Awards. He had to get up way early there, an hour earlier at St. Meinrad's, but he was gracious enough to do it. So enjoy the next few minutes of my conversation with Mark Bentley. Mark, good morning.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
All right. Thanks for turning it around on little sleep, because I know you're an hour earlier out there.
That's right. That's right. You know, it's going to be a long day, but I'm happy to be here.
Hey, it's Lent. You know, it's all about sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about the, you know, your general impressions first of the Oscars last night. I know there had been some controversy leading up to it after the nominees were announced, the lack of diversity, lack of color, let's say, among the nominees. And then you have Chris Rock as your host this year, not Neil Patrick Harris. And so what was your take on him pretty much pointing to the elephant in the room on a regular basis?
Wow. I mean, it was a real scorched earth. I thought going in, there might be a few jabs here and there. You know, you don't want to be too rough, but boy, he really went for it. And I think that there's a lot of truth to what he said. You know, as a church, we are one, but we're very diverse. We've got lots of local expression. And I think it's important for the film industry to reflect a very broad culture. And this is something that we've been doing quite well for many, many, many years.
You know, it's interesting, but as I commented earlier, the film industry does a lot at times, when it's at its best, to shine the spotlight on, you know, corruption and shortcomings in other institutions, whether it's politics or the Catholic Church, with Spotlight winning Best Film, but maybe not always having that light shone back on itself. So maybe that's a good thing.
I think so, yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about, you know, it's, of course, it's, I know, let's talk first about your love for movies and how that came about. And I guess for someone who loves the movies, the Oscars must be like a kid in a candy store.
It's my Super Bowl, you know, it's what I look forward to pretty much the whole year long, at least in terms of film. I mean, film, I've loved it since I saw Gone with the Wind for the first time. I was maybe 10 or 11, and that really unlocked my love of film. And people always ask me, Mark, what do you love about film? Well, for me, it's a combination of so many artistic fields. You've got writing, photography, costume, set design, acting. It's really almost like looking at a piece of art that changes at 24 frames per second. And it's available to all. You know, I grew up in Pikeville, and the same films that I could watch from 1952 that were shot in New York or Los Angeles, you know, it's available to everybody. It's not something that you have to travel to New York or L.A. to see. It's something that you can get in the comfort of your local theater or now in the comfort of your own home. And finally, you know, St. Ignatius of Loyola tells us that we're to find God in all things. And if film is art and God can talk through art, and as Catholics we believe in that incarnational reality, you know, we can find God in movies. It's not always easy, and there are some films in which it may be, you know, something that we need to work on as a society. But if it's art, I firmly believe that God is there present.
Now, I know that you are a convert to the Catholic faith from Protestant background. I know you love books as well, but did movies and literature have any role, even just in expanding your mind and your openness to things that maybe were different than what you had perceived them to be?
About that, I do know that films did play a role in my vocational discernment. Films like What, with that very heroic priest played by Carl Malden. The Mission was very influential in my discernment. Even on TV, in Father Mulcahy on MASH was a huge figure in my discernment. So in this case, film has changed my life in that way. Mm.
Have you seen Calvary?
I have. I have. Ooh. I'm a big fan of it. It's not a perfect film, but watching it as a seminarian, it makes you think, and it makes you appreciate what your average parish priest goes through.
Yes, I just saw it recently. I was just overwhelmed by it, really. And I wondered if somebody who's experiencing that call and that vocation must have felt about it.
Oh, I loved it. I can't wait to see it again.
Well, so let's talk about who won last night. Did you have in your mind some, did you make, you know, like people would do with the big game, they make their predictions. Did you make your own Oscar predictions?
I did. I did, and I published them in our student newsletter. I got most of them right. Spotlight was a big surprise in the sense that it was the front runner early on, kind of fizzled out a few weeks ago, and really came back with a vengeance. It's the first Best Picture winner since 1952 to win Best Picture and only one other Oscar.
And I think that was so Best Screenplay, I think, Best Adapted Screenplay. So what was your pick? What did you think was going to win Best Picture?
I thought it was going to be The Revenant. I've not seen the film, but some of the early tea leaves, the Guild Awards, look like it might be leaning in that direction. But in the end, Spotlight won the day, although Mad Max won the most last night, 6 awards, and The Revenant won 3. So it was very much spread.
You saw Mad Max, didn't you? I didn't see it.
I did. I liked it. You know, it's not one for a family audience, but it was very well designed, very well shot, and I think it had some very interesting things to say about the world that we live in.
I know you had also, I think you said you saw The Bridge of Spies, which is another one I want to see. I love Tom Hanks. How did that fit on Tom Hanks' career list, do you think?
I think it's, it's not top tier Tom Hanks, but it's a very good film. It won last night in a very surprise move. Mark Rylance won Best Supporting Actor over Sylvester Stallone, who was highly favored to win for reprising Rocky Balboa in Creed. He was a heavy favorite, but I guess, to use the boxing analogy, he was knocked out the final round.
That's right. I was pulling for him. I have a soft spot in my heart for Sylvester Stallone. But, you know, I think there's this feeling sometimes that actors become the sentimental favorite because maybe they've been at it for a long time. That was certainly the feeling, too, I think, with Leonardo DiCaprio, that, you know, he was going to win simply because, you know what, this is an Oscar-caliber film, and he's been nominated before. It's about time he won one. Your take on him winning the Best Actor?
Well, you know, again, I've not seen The Revenant, but the people I've talked to say it's a fierce film, and his performance is top-notch. If you look at the category, though, pretty much he was, by and large, the frontrunner the whole season. The only person who came really close was Michael Fassbender for Steve Jobs, and that film, once it kind of fell to the box office, never got its feedback. So, in reality, if Leo had lost, it would have been a huge upset, if only because there was a real dearth of talent in that category this year.
Yeah, I did see The Revenant, and it's a very dark film. There is a sign of some redemptive hope at the end. That bear attack will be with me for a long, long time. But, I think Leonardo DiCaprio is a great actor. And so, you know, even if maybe this film wasn't necessarily technically his best work, I still think he's certainly a worthy recipient.
Yeah, it's about time, I think, yeah. And speaking of The Revenant, Best Director, Alejandro González Iñárritu, he won Best Director last year. This is only the third time that the Oscars have given Best Director to the same person 2 years in a row. The first time was for John Ford for The Grapes of Wrath and How Green Was My Valley, and then Joseph L. Mankiewicz for A Letter to Three Wives and All About Eve. And that was 1950, so it's been 60 years since that happened. Just another kind of category that was blown out of the water. And speaking of records being set, Ennio Morricone won Best Original Soundtrack for his score to The Hateful Eight. 87 years old, it's the oldest winner of a competitive Oscar category. And from what I understand, he's very Catholic. He just wrote a Pope, a Mass for the Pope back in June. So it's kind of nice to see somebody who has worked a lot with Catholic-related things get an honor at his age.
Mm. We've only got about a minute left, Mark. I wanted to ask you what you thought about Spotlight. I was really afraid it was the church was going to really take some hits last night. I saw the acceptance speech. I thought for the most part it was fairly balanced.
Mm-hmm. I've not seen Spotlight yet. I want to. I know that the church has been supportive of the film from the get-go. They've voiced a lot of support through official and unofficial channels. Last night, one of the acceptance speeches, one of the producers said that, that this was supposed to be a call to the Vatican, a call to the church. Well, the church heard the call back in 2002, 2003, and has really implemented very proactive steps. The film...
Mark, we're about out of time, unfortunately. I really appreciate you taking time to be with us, okay?
Thank you. God bless, Mike.
You too, Mark. We'll be back. The Mike Allen Show. Minutes before the hour, This Thing Called Love, number one, 1980 on this date. Freddie Mercury, the late Freddie Mercury, pray for the repose of his soul. Indeed, if you ever do any reading on Freddie Mercury, it's had a very special relationship with his mother. He tried to shield her really from the excesses of his performance, his life as a performer. And but had a very tender relationship with her. So, again, only God knows the soul, and certainly an unbelievably talented and passionate performer, for sure. 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. That number, by the way, you can call or text, or you can post a response on Facebook or Twitter. I'm asking a question of the day about the Michigan Catholic Conference, who is now offering insurance benefits to the partners of its employees, including same-sex partners, but not limited to same-sex partners. Now, you may say, what in the heck is somebody who has a same-sex partner or a same-sex spouse, civil spouse, doing working for the Catholic Church? Well, there are different perspectives on that, right? I mean, there is the perspective of some that somebody who's working in a, let's say, working in a financial role in the church, for example. Or, you know, working, you know, in a non-ministry related position, perhaps, could be employed by the church, even though their life is publicly in contradiction to Catholic moral teaching. I don't know. I think that's a topic and an issue for another time. It is going to be increasingly an issue that brings the church into engagement with the court system and with this understanding of how religious liberty functions in the midst of these broader societal laws against discrimination. And this is evidently one way that the Catholic Conference is trying to, in the words, I think, of St. Paul in Romans 12:18, as far as possible, live at peace with everyone, offering these benefits to what are called a legally domiciled adult, an interdependent, financially independent, legally domiciled adult. Who shares living expenses with a Michigan Catholic Conference employee. So do you think it is a reasonable compromise? Because as the spokesman of the Catholic Conference says, this plan is residency-based, not relationship-based. So lots of people can qualify for it. Do you think it's a reasonable compromise, or is it a capitulation? Is it a betrayal of Catholic moral teaching? 573-4BREAD-4. Call or text. Email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, if you want to chime in. Before we get back to this John Kasich story, I want to look back in history a little bit on some things that happened on this day throughout the ages. March 11th.
Where are we, dude?
These are the circuits of history, gentlemen. They'll take us to any point in time we wish.
Where are we?
Gentlemen, we're history.
Don't know much about history.
On this day, March 11th, 843 A.D., icon veneration was officially reinstated at the Hagia Sophia Cathedral in Constantinople. This was after the iconoclast controversy in which there were some Christians who got the idea that icons were a bad thing. Somehow, maybe a disobedience of the command against idols. But there's a difference between an icon and an idol, right? You look through an icon to the deeper reality, and go back even to the when Moses was commanded to make a serpent on a pole that those who'd been bitten by the snakes would look at and be healed. Divine images go way back even before the time of Christ. Anyway, I digress. 1302 on this day was, according to Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet's wedding day. Of course, we know it did not end well for the star-crossed lovers. And as has been noted most recently, Shakespeare did not write his play as an exaltation of romantic love against family concerns, but rather as a cautionary tale. Changes the way you look at it. On this day in 1936, Antonin Scalia was born, so the late justice would have been 80 years old today. 1958, on this day, Charles Van Doren finally loses on the TV game show 21. And if you've seen the film Quiz Show, which I've recommended before, with Ray Fiennes and Rob Morrow and some others, just an outstanding parable on the issue of integrity and honesty. He lost on purpose, as they would discover. Happy 23rd birthday to Anthony Davis, he of the unibrow, former University of Kentucky, multi-talented center of the New Orleans Pelicans. And let's see, on this day in 2004, 10 bombs exploded in quick succession across the commuter rail network in Madrid, Spain, killing 191 people and wounding more than 2,000 in an attack linked to Al-Qaeda-inspired militants. Boy, remember when all we had to worry about was Al-Qaeda? And they turned out to be the AAA farm club of terror before ISIS came along. So rest in peace, all those who died in Madrid in that terrible attack and scarring a community. And, oh, Lord, bringing into the violence that just seems ever-present in our world. 573-4-BREAD-4, if you want to chime in. Back to this story about John Kasich. As we said, John Kasich, who grew up in this town in western Pennsylvania, and went to this high school there in McKees Rock called Stowe Rocks High School. And actually, as a senior in high school back in 1970, during a very heated meeting between 400 students and parents, which they met to hear complaints from blacks that they were being subjected to de facto segregation, it was the scrawny senior, John Kasich, the son of a postman, who stood up in the front and tried to calm people down, much like he has tried to be a calming voice in the Republican debates. But this article from the Washington Post, I'm going to put a link to it on the show's Facebook page, by Michael Cranish, really giving an insight into Kasich's faith background that I wasn't aware of. He grew up in a very rough area there in western PA. And as Kasich himself said, it was really tough. Beautiful people, but really tough. Kasich, whose heritage includes Croatian and Czech backgrounds, said in an interview, his refuge was his church on the hill called Mother of Sorrows. As Kasich entered the fourth grade, he put on a black cassock, slipped a white hip-length garment on top, and headed to a new calling, to serve as an altar boy. His dream, he told friends, was to be a priest. In this area where most people were Catholic, such dreams were not unusual, and often they didn't last long, but Kasich seemed different. He would be celibate, leading a flock with religion always at the forefront. His friends were convinced that the priesthood was Kasich's life course. Many thought he was aiming even higher. They nicknamed him Pope. Even the head priest at Mother of Sorrows, the Reverend Joseph Farina, called him that. He said, I was determined to be the best altar boy Mother of Sorrows had ever seen by a mile. Kasich wrote in his memoir, Every Other Monday. He could be overzealous, it says, and not just on the basketball courts, where he compensated for his small size by perfecting his outside shot. His friend, Sersoni, who we mentioned earlier, who often prayed at church with Kasich during the school lunch break, mentioned one day he also wanted to be an altar boy. Sersoni has never forgotten Kasich's response. So his friend comes and says, I want to be an altar boy too. Sersoni said, he said I was too fat and there wasn't a cassock that would fit me. He talked me out of being an altar boy. Asked why, Sersoni gave a one-word answer delivered affectionately, competition. He did not want altar boy competition. Evidently, Kasich also spoke frequently with an assistant pastor, the Reverend Arthur Tambucci, who oversaw the youth programs. One day, he walked into Tambucci's study. He looked at the books on the shelves. Tambucci said he had read every one, and Kasich vowed to do the same. But what Kasich didn't know is that this associate pastor, Father Tambucci, was reconsidering his role after 5 years at Mother of Sorrows. He had become enamored with one of the parishioners, a young woman named Sarah Michelangelo. In time, Tambucci asked Sarah to marry him. He left Mother of Sorrows just as Kasich graduated from high school and married Sarah 2 years later. Many of the people in my high school class, my husband either performed their marriages or baptized their children, she said. Some of Kasich's friends wondered whether Tambucci's decision caused him to question his own desire to be a priest. Kasich, in an interview, said he made the decision separately when he had an epiphany. The problem was, I couldn't be a priest if I liked girls. That was the fundamental issue, Kasich said. I'd like to talk to some of my priest friends. They would probably take issue with that statement. I'm sure that there are many of them who like girls. But yet they did not reject marriage because it was earthly marriage because it was bad. They rather chose to embrace the heavenly marriage that we are all destined to forsake earthly marriage, which is a great good for an even greater good, our ultimate destiny. Evidently, Sarah Tambucci recalls that Kasich one day made clear to her husband, the former priest, that he was changing his ambition. She said that before her husband left the priesthood, Kasich walked into his study and made a startling announcement. One day I will run for president of the United States. Well, he's doing exactly that. Interesting. I'll post a link to it on the show's Facebook page. So that's it for this edition of the Monday Best of Interviews program here on the Mike Allen Show. Again, enjoying some time with family. Thanks for indulging me. By God's grace, I hope you have a great rest of your day, and we'll be back tomorrow with another Best of Interview program. Enjoy, and Christ is risen. He is risen indeed. Blessings.